The dream is to leave the city, go to where the grass is green, farm the land, breathe fresh air, and grow food people will want to pay good money for. This dream leads us to ask, can it make dollars and cents to become a farmer?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1292nd edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Guaymas who are tuned into the podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, many of us dream about leaving the city and becoming a farmer. Before you make that leap, consider the following from the book Metro Farm by yours truly, Michael Olson. Though agriculture is practiced by gardeners and farmers alike, the similarity ends there. Farmers must develop a proficiency in an additional technology, that of converting green plants into green money. Gardening is an avocation. As Sir Francis Bacon said, it provides us with the greatest refreshment. It also supplements our food supply, adds color to our lives, and is an excellent way to spend Sunday afternoon. Because gardening is so refreshing, we tend to project the feeling onto the business of farming. This is not a realistic projection. Farming is a vocation. People farm so they can purchase food for their table, a roof over their head, and clothes for their back. As a vocation, farming has an intensity of character unlike gardening. If the need is there, farmers work Sunday morning before breakfast. And if the need is still there, they work Sunday evening long after the dinner dishes have been removed from the kitchen table. You may have the technological proficiency to be a rose gardener. Your roses may be so perfectly shaped, brilliantly hued, and delicately scented that people will travel for miles to see them on display with their blue ribbons at the county fair. But this ability alone is not sufficient to enable you to prosper as a rose farmer. You must compete with other rose farmers for the consumer dollars and win. For those who are dreaming the dream of leaving the city to take up farming, it would pay to listen to those who have. With that in mind, we welcome two who are living the dream. Beth Hoffman, farmer and author of Bet the Farm, The Dollars and Cents of Growing Food in America, and John Hoagland, fifth generation farmer, Whippoorwill Creek Farm in Lovilla. Is that right, Iowa?
Lovilla.
It's Lovilla. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, so, married with farm, right?
Yeah, married with farm.
Married with farm. Well, you have a very interesting backstory because you were both city people and you made that leap. And you made it, you had a pretty good living in the city. Beth, let's start with you. You are a college professor.
Yeah, we lived in San Francisco. Just recently, I was actually born and raised in the East Coast, New York City area. And yes, I was a professor in media studies at the University of San Francisco and a freelance journalist covering food and agriculture for about 25 years.
Mm-hmm. And you looked at across the way and there was a farmer that came into your life.
Yes. He was my neighbor. So John actually we lived in a row house, a three apartment row house. And I met him, and probably within the first 5 minutes, he told me that he had just been visiting Iowa and with his sons. And I said something profound like Iowa. And I had never really thought about Iowa. I probably couldn't have picked it out on a map. But he proudly said, yes, Iowa, and told me that was his plan, was to move back as soon as his kids were out of high school.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what happened.
And there was something about the farm boy that caught your attention, and you eventually got married, and there you are. Now, John, when I considered your story, fifth generation farm, Whippoorwill Farm, Whippoorwill Creek Farm, I think.
Whippoorwill Creek Farm.
Yeah. And so what are you doing in the big city with two boys?
Well, I had moved after college. I had moved first to Wyoming, and then wound up in Wyoming starting to cook, and then realized if I really wanted to be a good cook, I should probably go to school and figure out how to, you know, really learn how to do it. And so I went to culinary school in San Francisco, and that's how I wound up in San Francisco.
There you go. And two boys. I was just wondering, you know, if you have two young boys, I think the best place in the world for two young boys, 8 and 9 or 8 and 10, I think it was, would probably be on a farm. Do your kids like going to the farm?
Yeah, they still love coming out to the farm. They're both in San Francisco at the present. One may be in the future might come out to the farm. We'll see. You never know what will happen. I thought I was leaving the farm probably for good when I left, and then shortly thereafter decided I was coming back. But as it turned out, it took me quite a bit longer than an immediate turnaround.
Yeah. What made the two of you decide to go back to the farm from the city? Beth?
Well, it was always John's dream. You know, as I mentioned, he said that he was going from the beginning. So it was, you know, I knew that he was going probably without me if I didn't want to go. So he debates that, I think. But he loved it from deep within his soul. So that's how we ended up considering it.
Mm-hmm. And what sold you? I mean, you had to buy into this equation. So what sold you?
Well, I think I had lived in many different places over the course of my adulthood. So it wasn't outrageous to live somewhere else and try something else that I hadn't done before. And I also had reported on food and agriculture, like I said, for probably 25 years at that point. So it wasn't out of the question. I mean, it seemed a bit like a gift to be able to try to put into play what I had learned over the course of all these years.
And in the course of your writing about food and agriculture, had you ever seen a farm like Whippoorwill?
Well, I guess that's, you know, ours seemed unique, so it would be hard to say I've seen that. But certainly, I saw a lot of farms that were transitioning from one generation to the next, transitioning in terms of trying to grow different things and not have the whatever the commodity was in the region. So I guess I had seen it. And talk to people in all different kinds of circumstances, but it's a very different thing to live it.
And you lived it. And you know, in the course of your courtship and marriage and whatnot, you spent some summertime out in Iowa on the farm. And did it kind of grow on you like that?
Yes, definitely. I mean, like I said, when John first said Iowa, and I didn't even know where that was exactly, of course, I had heard of it. But coming out here and learning that this part of the state is rolling hills and a fair amount of forest and just a very different than the kind of stereotypes of the flat Iowa corn kind of belt, that this is not that. So working on the farm and starting to plant trees and fix fence and chase cattle and all these kinds of things over the summertime certainly gave me my own connection to the land.
Mm-hmm. And what about the physical part of it, the work? You're getting blisters on your hands.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I mean, I've always been sort of an amateur athlete and someone who liked being active. And so I liked the idea of getting up and doing something with my body each day. It's different, of course, when you have to do it all day long. That's a very different thing, but I really enjoyed that. And I think there's a fair amount of people in this country, if you think about the diversity of humans and then how many people we have sort of sitting behind a computer, sitting still at a desk all day, it seems out of line that, you know, there's got to be millions of people who should be outside who are inside.
Amen to that. I always almost think that the great tragedy of the industrialization of agriculture is that we took farmers and people off the land and replaced them with equipment and chemicals. And all those people who used to have good physical, challenging, mentally demanding work are hanging around the street corners in hoodies, you know. So just the thought of having that work and missing that, I think, is a great detriment to culture and society. But that's just me. John.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I just like to add that, you know, a lot of that, what we sort of just chalk up as like industrialization, though, was agribusiness finding these niches where there was a real desire to get rid of weeds, things like weeds, much easier because it was a lot of work. So I think that a lot of the people around here very readily and happily adopted chemicals and genetically modified plants that would keep down that work and allow them to have a different kind of lifestyle.
Well, having been
not only that, but it not only takes less time, but it makes it much simpler because you can do a simple corn, soybean rotation as opposed to having to fallow your land, you know, and either put it into, you know, pasture or alfalfa or oats, you know, that it takes extra steps out and makes your land in theory more profitable. But just a little further.
Yeah. Well, you know, having been a teenage herbicide myself, I certainly understand the desire not to do that under the hot sun with a hoe. Much better to just fly on some spray and call it a day if you can get away with it. But that depends on how you intend to grow and what you intend to grow. And so that'll be one of the big questions that we bring up today is how do we go back to the farm and grow the kind of food people really want to have, that they'll be willing to pay money for? So not so certain, you know, people want to have the kind of food that is grown with those chemicals, and they're looking for something else. And something tells me you too were pursuing that dream as well. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking about betting the farm, the dollars and cents of growing food in America. We have Beth Hoffman, who is the author of the book, but I bet John Hoagland got some words in edgewise, I bet. They are farming now in Whippoorwill Creek Farm in Iowa. We will be right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about going back to the land with a couple of very bright people who left the city, the big city of San Francisco, and moved to Iowa. And what an experience that must have been. What was your initial feeling when you finally opened the door and closed it behind you and realized that you would not be going back to San Francisco right away, Beth?
The feeling was, it was agony. I actually agonized over, you know, leaving my job and how that would go. And I took a leave of absence for a year so that I, you know, could go back if I wanted to. But I knew that if we were going to really do this, I had to really jump in with both feet. I couldn't be half-time in San Francisco, for example, and half-time on the farm. I needed to really live here. But I'd love to also go back to the whole idea of going back to the farm. Will we cover that in a later part of this?
Sure. Let's start right now.
Yeah. Well, just this idea, you know, I try and dispel a lot of the myths in this book. And I think this part of what I call the agrarian myth of farmers getting back to the land, living a simple life, being virtuous and independent. A lot of that actually is, I looked at the history of it as well. So to look at what our agricultural system was over the years, and found that really that whole idea of us going back to something, there really wasn't a time that was before when it was done right.
John, there wasn't right?
Right. There was exactly like John's grandfather, or John's father, Leroy, who's played a big part in the book. He told me that his grandfather, you know, quote, raped the land out here. And if you think about things like the Dust Bowl and what was going on, even all the way back to the beginning of our country as a colony, we were established to grow commodities for export, mostly. And we were, this whole area of Iowa always grew corn. So there's not like a time before that we can say, well, let's go do it like our grandparents did. They were growing corn and cattle here. They had longer rotations between things, as John talked about. They grew corn and then alfalfa, and they pastured and they had livestock. That was very different, but I really, that whole concept that it was done well before and agribusiness came in and ruined it is something that I really tried to dispel in the book.
Mm-hmm. It probably wasn't an ideal that we idealize. And, you know, I recently did a show with another college professor of antiquities, and he took us back to the time of Pliny the Elder, who talked about how industrial agriculture was ruining the farmsteads in and around Rome way back then.
Wow.
So we have a way of idealizing these things, but sometimes they weren't so ideal. John, let me ask you this. With respect to Whippoorwill Farms, what kind of farm was it when Leroy was running it, and how did you and Beth intend to change this world?
Well, my father ran a very conventional farm for South Central Iowa. We do have rolling hills down here, and the fields are much smaller. It's much more designed down here for raising livestock. We raised a lot of pigs, we raised a lot of cattle, and then corn and soybeans was about a quarter to a third of our farm.
Okay.
But he adopted chemical use pretty early. He was one of the first farmers in the state to build a confinement unit for pigs. And as such, being one of the first, they were fairly successful right out of the gate. And made quite a bit of money, but very, very quickly became small potatoes compared to when they started. They were some of the largest hog producers in the state. But so I saw all that happened. You know, I saw that, you know, the chemical use and the barrels of chemical leftovers that were leaching into the ground, and I saw, you know, the detriment, you know, because we had raised hogs outside before dad started raising them inside, and what a detriment it was to the hog's health, what a detriment it was to my dad's health, and how it started to affect the neighbors, because a lot of the neighbors are still trying to raise pigs outside. And I remember at one point, one of our neighbors coming over and talking with my dad and saying, the slaughter facility won't even buy my pigs because they're raised outdoors. And so he had to stop raising pigs, and he eventually, you know, his kids didn't take over the farm. He lost the farm. And, so when we came out here, you know, I had worked for years in the food business, mostly in restaurants, but also in produce and wine. And in, you know, in California, they're quite a ways ahead of us as far as organic production has gone. But I knew that there was a tremendous need for it. You know, the organic and natural food section continues to grow, and there just hasn't been a way to fill it. And I knew that we could come out here and do some different things and start to become a little more niche farmers rather than just commodity farmers.
Well, Beth, you brought up the notion of commodities. What exactly is the difference between a commodity crop and the kind of crop you would want to grow?
Well, commodity is anything that you grow, and then once it leaves your farm, it just is sort of thrown in with everything else that is similar to it. So it can be something like corn or soybeans. It can also be hogs that are, you know, you would go to the supermarket and you'd really have no idea where they're coming from or what breed they might be. And they're raised all to be exactly alike or similar enough that there's no differentiation. So one of the reasons why a slaughterhouse would say we're not going to now slaughter hogs that are grown outside is because they might have very different sizes now, and so the facility isn't set up for that sort of variation. So what's different is not doing that. So things that retain their place of origin and have what they call now like a niche market for them. So if you buy something from a farmer or a wholesaler and you know pretty specifically where you're getting it from and what farm, what the practices are, that's very different from a commodity.
Mm-hmm. And you talk a lot about economies of scale, and John brought up his observation of how that economies of scale worked when his father built a processing facility, a confined animal feeding operation on the farm for the hogs. Instead of growing them outside, grew them inside. People looked at that and thought, wow, that's a very interesting concept. And the next thing John said is that they became huge and you became small. And it seems like in a commodity industry, he or she who grows the most for the least wins.
That's part of the concept. And this is one of the other real big myth that I deal with in the book, is something I call the bigger is better myth. And the idea behind it is, yes, you reach an economy of scale where all these exorbitant costs of chemicals, costs of seeds, costs of giant machinery, that it all sort of gets evened out over a really large area, and then you can make more per bushel. Everybody feels like they're in competition, because that's something that's very promoted. If you look at any kind of advertising about seeds, for example, it'll say like beat your competition, have higher yield. So the problem is that everybody gets in this race for higher yields, which every single time over the course of history, if you look at it, results in overproduction. So the price actually ends up getting driven down as there's more and more product. So that's exactly what Leroy, you know, the neighbors, he told me the story how they would come and say, you know, people were really angry here when they saw that these confinement units were going up because they knew that there was just going to be a market that was flooded with hogs. And Leroy and his group got in first, you know, so they actually made some money. But by the time they got out, which was in the early 90s, the bottom completely dropped out of the market. And what he told me was that hogs were selling for $8 a head and they cost $75 to raise.
Wow.
So that's often what happens when you go for this economy of scale. It just creates momentum in the market, and you have to continue to find new markets and more new markets, and that's just not really that possible anymore.
Well,
there's not many new markets to be had in the world.
When you and John were sitting around the kitchen table in Berkeley talking about how you were going to make money and make this thing work, you had to know that you're going to have to go up against and compete with those who have giant economies of scale, or at least were very, very big. How did you decide to go up against that? And what kind of farm are you going to build that could survive in that world?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, something that I point out in the book is that you have to realize that every farm is operating within this context. There's a context of all of this competition going on and everything else that's involved, policy and consumer behavior and the weather and everything. And it makes for a very stressful environment for farmers. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, farmer depression, farmer suicide, because the competition and that feeling of having to keep up and get ahead is really difficult. I think that we, and I don't know, John can weigh in as well about this, we've tried to not really think of ourselves in competition with other farmers, but I think that this is one of the ways that we can really rephrase and re-describe what's going on in farming, is that instead of looking at it in these mythological ways, like the bigger is better, and seeing everybody in competition, we could actually view ourselves as working together. It's something that could very well benefit farmers, everybody. If the supply was limited, for example, if farmers worked together to limit their own supply, mm-hmm. the price would go up. Well, and so that's something that we try and think about on our farm, is how can we work with the other farmers? And we do within Iowa. We're constantly referring customers to each other, trying to come up with new ways of how to sell and market together.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, you're out there in Lovell, what was the name of the city you were in?
Lovella.
And is that a market of sufficient size that you can market your beef and your meat products there, or do you have to reach outside that market?
We have to reach outside the market, but, you know, that's one of the advantages of the internet today is, you know, we have a substantial reach. And, you know, and we are just getting started, so our base is quite small. But so far, we've had, you know, an outlet for all of our beef. You know, we do grass-fed, grass-finished beef. So it is a different product from, you know, your commodity beef. And people are specifically looking at it. I've had neighbors refer people to me because they raise cattle that are grain-finished. And they'll have a customer come to them and ask, you know, do you have any grass finished beef? I want grass fed, grass finished beef. And they have to say no, but I know a guy who does that, and they will, you know, forward them to me. So it's, we can work together. I'd also quickly to address something that you had said, he who gets bigger, in the end wins is,
Did I say that?
You were saying that, I can't remember exactly how you phrased, but he who gets bigger, and finishes with more wins, but in the end, you don't win. You just go on to the next round. It's like being voted off the island. Each iteration, there are a few less farmers because some people got voted off the island. Some people didn't make it because they didn't get quite big enough. And it's a race to the bottom, getting bigger and competing, because every time somebody gets bigger, that means somebody else isn't around anymore.
Yeah. Well, I've been working with a book called Metro Farm. It's about farming small parcels of land in or near the city. And so part of that is you have to take your product to market and compare, and it has to sit on the shelf with everybody else's product. And so I do take a competitive stance that I do think that farmers have to compete, but I do also think that they certainly can cooperate, and cooperatives have been in agriculture forever, and provide a good way of competing with the world. And we see that out here in California with the berry industry and so on. Oops, holy smokes, we're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to learn more about farming, and we're going to ask whether is it possible to make sense and money out of farming these days. Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in Metro Farm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than Metro Farm, a truly comprehensive manual. Metro Farm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. Metro Farm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And in not competing with those very big farms like Beth and John are not doing, they are really competing with them because they're selling something that those giants of agriculture can't produce, and that's grass-fed, hand-raised beef. And my goodness, would I love to get my hands on some of that, right?
Well, we have some for you.
Good.
Only in Iowa.
Oh, okay. So when I picture your farm, I picture green grass and happy cows. When I picture industrial agriculture, I picture, you know, a confined animal feeding lot, which I don't think is all that bad. It's kind of like a city, you know. People live in cities, and some animals live in confined animal feeding operations. So that's the way they grow food. But I prefer to eat food that was grown by people like you, people who I can reach out to and kind of look in their eyes and see what's in their food. And I guess there is a significant number of farmers like you out there in the world. Is it making sense for them, Beth?
Well, I was just thinking many different things as you're saying all of that. But yes, to address it, yes, it does it make sense? I think it makes sense to a lot of people, obviously, like you're saying, that it's a type of food that many people want. I think it's very important to understand the differences between the food and not, again, to rely on sort of the romance of it, the happy cows. Like, you know, right. I don't know exactly if cows are happy or not. What's important.
But you did. But you did once ask if they had their own names.
I did. And that's like in the first pages about talking about how kind of ignorant I was about the whole thing, which is, you know, a great place to start with mm-hmm. what we actually know. I think for us, the important parts are that we are working to regenerate the land, that we're adding to the place, and we're building a brand that has value in itself. It's not just the fertility of the land, what they call the corn suitability rating, is what everybody in Iowa is looking for when you're trying to purchase a piece of land. So that part of the model makes a lot of sense for people. I think there's a lot of people interested in taking over family farms that maybe were conventionally run and doing something different. It becomes difficult in the economics of it, the finances, because many times people allow those desires for an environmental improvements or even social improvements, like let's say I want to, you know, feed my community. Those kinds of things researchers have found often then lead to self-exploitation, farmers spending way too much time and energy on the land and then not being paid for it at all. So it leads to a lot of burnout. And I would say that people are often afraid of charging what it costs to actually grow food. And it's something that's, again, like a little assumed that the market will set the price, not the farmer will set the price based on what it costs, because that's how it works in the commodity world. You just take what you're given as a farmer. But that's part of what being a niche farmer and working directly with consumers means, is that we can set the price based on what it actually costs us mm-hmm. to grow.
Have you ever heard of the concept of farm parity?
Yes, I have heard of the George Naylor and Patty Naylor are wonderful farmers nearby, and they are very active in that concept.
And do you think it possible that farmers can actually charge consumers what it costs to grow and throw in enough so that the farmer actually makes some money?
Yes, I do think it's possible. I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about part of parity is limiting the supply as well. And they talk a bit about that being done on a government policy level. I won't speak to that because that's not my forte, but I do believe, like I said, that farmers, if they organize, even commodity farmers, can ensure that the supply is limited and that their costs, they're paid the cost of production. If you look right now at what's going on in the cattle industry, and there's a lot of questioning about the antitrust laws and monopolies that have grown in the cattle industry to dictate what the prices are going to be. There's some looking into that congressionally and otherwise. But it's a great example of when farmers get together and they actually oppose something that's going on. I don't think it necessarily goes far enough. They are talking about there just being kind of more transparency in the pricing, but not guaranteeing a price that would work for those cattle people.
And it seems, as I travel up and down the food chain, that farmers are intrinsically independent and resist being beholden to outside interests like a corporation in which you're contracted to produce X number of chickens to or something like that. It seems like there's...
Yeah, I would say that that's part of that myth, and I talk about it also as part of the agrarian myth that goes all the way back to Jeffersonian Thomas Jefferson writing about farmers being virtuous and independent and the kind of the basis of democracy in this country. I would say that farmers are probably as diverse as any other group of people, and that there's people who think that independence is super important and people who are willing to work together. They've been in co-ops, as you said, forever. There's lots of cooperatives that have celebrated their 100th anniversary. Most of those are in the Midwest. So the idea that people don't want to work together is kind of ridiculous. And it's also ridiculous to think that you are independent and, quote, free when you're operating in a contract system where you're told exactly what to farm, when to farm it, how to farm it. So I don't see where there's any freedom or independence in that, actually. It's just part of the mythology.
Lots of mythology to work with. And in that regard, you speak a lot about the need to have a different kind of conversation about agriculture. Where do you start that?
Yeah, I think, as I've alluded to, things like talking about farmers working together is a great example. And there's great places to look at that, like I'm saying, with the cattle industry, for example. New narratives would also talk about farmers caring for themselves and their families as part of their top priorities, that the farm has to be financially viable or it can't actually persist. So we like to talk about all of the environmental things in sustainable agriculture, but very often nobody mentions the difficult economics. So I think that those are places as well to change the conversation.
Yeah. If the farm isn't making money, then it's not really a farm. It's more like a garden. Is that fair enough to say?
Well, I don't think so, because I think, you know, hobbies, and people like to talk about hobby farming and they like to discredit. You see a lot of the data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, for example, that says that 90% of farms just, are not producing. They produce something like 40% of the food. The other 10% produce most of our food. But then they just chalk it up to being like, oh, those are hobby farms. Those are farms that don't need to make money. And that's actually probably not true if you look at the data of who are those farms. There's a lot of people who are farming commodities. There's a lot of people who are farming at more than full-time kinds of hours. So you can't really chalk it all up to being a hobby or just kind of inconsequential in the large scheme of things.
Okay. And I'd like to take it back a little bit to Leroy, because the image that you painted of you going from San Francisco back to Iowa and negotiating with Leroy, who's been running the farm for a long time and doing it his way, and you sat down around the kitchen table with him and negotiated. What was his reaction when you told him that you and John would like to take over the farm and do it your way?
Well, he initially was very skeptical. There's a scene in the book that I talk about where he, after I told him we might want to do organics, he came in with a, he went out back and he came back with this hoe that had been worn down to like an inch wide. And he was like, this is what organics is. It's working, you know, to get rid of all of these weeds. It's so much labor. That's what organics is. But I think he's kind of changed a bit. I think, John, maybe you have something to say about your dad and how he's kind of evolved in this.
Yeah,
I think that his take on the whole thing was very much from the point of view when we first came out. He was looking at it from the point of view of a conventional farmer. He thought we were going to kind of continue doing what he had done, but just with hoes, you know. And he didn't understand there are a lot of systems, a lot of different ways of doing things. It was outside his experience. Mm-hmm. And as we've gone along, I remember I was going out and moving my cattle daily. And I went in one day and sat down, and this was still in his skeptical phase. And he said, that's a lot of sugar for a cent, you know, and meaning that I'm doing an awful lot of work for not much. And, but as we had a couple of dry years and I'm moving my cattle daily, our neighbors were, you know, they were moving, you know, they move their cows every, you know, when the pasture's empty, they move it to the next pasture. And I had grass left, had a lot of grass left, and they were all struggling. And he began to see that, you know, it was a different way of doing things, but it wasn't necessarily, you know, I wasn't going to fail because of that, you know. And he began to see that what I was doing actually worked better in some ways. So I do a lot more work probably with my cattle, but I have a lot calmer cattle than he used to have. And I have I maintain my grass in a much better fashion so that the cattle always have something to eat. So he's come around as he's seen these changes that we have wrought on the farm. And so now I think he's kind of all in behind us. So.
Okay. With that, I'd like to challenge Beth a little bit on the notion that there is no such thing as happy cows, because I recall once being on Polyface Farm with Joel Salatin, and I watched as he moved his cattle from one pasture to the next, and he had a lead cow that he called, and he took the fence down, and this lead cow, I swear, she was smiling when she went into the new grass. I just swear that she was a genuine happy cow.
I think, you know, we kind of love to see them go into the paddock and they literally kick up their heels. They,
yes,
like, you know, if you look like a bucking cow, a horse or something, they kind of look like that, where they are prancing and they're excited. I think
they really feel good about it.
Yeah. I think that they feel like they are truly themselves. themselves. I think that there's like an integrity that they get to display and feel. I just think that what ends up happening when you call them happy is that you can then put, you know, a cartoon picture of a cow with a smile on a container, and it kind of, what it does is it makes people feel good and people feel happy. So the difference between it, you know, I once said to John, I said, you know, cows, most of the time they're just standing around eating. They're just like literally just standing there. They're not doing the kick in the heels up thing or whatever. And I said, what's different about that than them standing around in a feedlot? And he said this very profound line was like, he said, it's like your kids, you know, your kids can be perfectly happy, quote unquote, sitting on the couch eating potato chips. But that's not actually bringing out who they are and the best of what they are. Wow. And immediately I understood the difference between a cow on pasture kicking its heels up. And even if it's just standing there eating, it's getting to be sort of who it should be, as opposed to standing there on its own manure, eating something that upsets its stomach, you know.
Well, we just ran out of time, but you've left me hungry for your beef. Beth the Farm, Beth Hoffman and John Hoagland, Married with Farm. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.